Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 17th, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today we're going to examine why it is that, despite ample cause, the U.S. Congress has failed to impeach Vice President Dick Cheney, the Vice President Dick Cheney responsible for the failed war in Iraq, the Vice President Dick Cheney who is committed to extending that with a war in Iran. And we'll also look at the related question, which is why have our elected representatives failed to act to protect our nation from the present financial crisis, which is spiraling out of control, threatening millions of families with foreclosure and the banking system with disintegration. As we have been reporting, Lyndon LaRouche said that Nancy Pelosi has failed in her responsibilities as Speaker of the House as she's been protecting Dick Cheney from impeachment. By taking impeachment off the table, as she has repeatedly insisted, she's made Congress an object of ridicule with a poll approval rating of below 11% right now. And Lyndon LaRouche has said she must go. However, in a very provocative piece that appeared in the November 9th, 2007 Executive Intelligence Review, with the provocative title, "The Force of Tragedy, The Mask of Nancy Pelosi," Mr. LaRouche makes the point, as only he can, that the tragedy does not lie in the failed leadership of Speaker Pelosi, but in the overall corruption of our society. My guests today have engaged in lifelong studies of this principle of tragedy. Gerald Rose from the editorial board of the Executive Intelligence Review, and I'm also honored to welcome back my friend Robert Beltran, an actor and drama coach who's committed to encouraging his students in the investigation of the principle of tragedy through working on dramas by especially William Shakespeare and Friedrich Schiller. So, Jerry and Robert, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Harley.
And we'll also be joined today by LaRouche Youth Movement member Joanne McAndrew, who, in addition to working on drama with Robert Beltran, is engaged in our efforts to jolt the Congress out of its subservience to the City of London controllers of Pelosi, George Shultz and Felix Rohatyn. So we have a lot to cover, but I'd like to begin with two quotes from LaRouche's paper, which I think get at this principle of tragedy. And then after these quotes, I'd like both Jerry and Robert to give us their thoughts on what Lynn is discussing here. So he writes, "In all classical tragedy, some voiceless force of will, such as the ghost of Hamlet, grips the ensemble of the parts played by nearly all among the principal players in the drama. Those characters cannot free themselves from the grip of that encompassing destiny over their will." Then after quoting from Horatio at the end of Hamlet, where he speaks over the corpse of Hamlet, he goes ahead and says, "What is it which had gripped the characters played on stage, such that each performed as under the grip of an unseen wicked will, compelled to act as if by the whim of a higher unseen voiceless power? Why similarly did so many Democratic members of the Congress submit to Pelosi's scornful whips and lashes when her folly and its consequences were so insistently, repeatedly transparent? What strange, eerie force of compulsion impelled them to submit again and again and again? What is she, the bearer of this mask of anarchy, and in real life this mere pathetic creature, that they, seemingly strong-willed men and women, should degrade themselves and their nation's fate so again and again, as if by the whips of her errant will?" And then a little bit later, he makes the following point. And as you'll see from our discussion, we are looking at the what you might call the clear subtext or the real meaning of tragedy in this. Lynn writes, "In all competently composed classical tragedy, there is a silent, invisible power which herds the members of society by force of will into a restricted range of allowed choices of behavior." He writes, "The force of tragedy expressed is of that silent electric fence quality of control which is of the type expressed implicitly on stage by the devilishly fancied image of the phantom of Hamlet's father. So, as the victim of such control over his fears or rages is induced to destroy himself or herself, so an entire nation like our own may be driven, as recently, like a herd of maddened cattle, as by the crafted terror of 9/11, or Hermann Göring's earlier Cheney-like role in orchestrating the 1933 burning of the Reichstag, into destroying itself, even its entire culture. So let me begin with Jerry. This is very dramatic writing from Lynn, but what are your thoughts on this?
Well, anyone who has not read this piece as a whole, because it's one thorough piece of composition, does not understand what we're actually living through. Because Lynn counterposes to this force of tragedy, and it's completely ironic the way he develops it, that the force of tragedy is the inability to be human, because the and that he defines in the piece what it means through history with the astrogation of early man from the peoples of the sea, the discovery of the great astronomical calendars, to the creation of a seafaring culture that creates the relative potential population density, which allows us to move inland. That the whole sweep of humanity is totally different, but that societies, whole civilizations have failed because of what Lynn defines as this force of tragedy. And you know, this Hamlet ghost thing, I don't know what, I would really like Robert to comment also on this. This is quite something what Lynn says about this, because I've been in many discussions and debates about what is this ghost, because the ghost appears in warlike beaver up, as they say, in warlike clothing. The ghost says that indeed he had been killed, which is true, by Claudius. The ghost said that the kingdom is usurped, which is true.
Yep.
All of it's true. And he calls on Hamlet to act. But what is the irony of this thing? You see, the ghost is Hamlet realizing all of this, because Robert, you'll corroborate this. You know what Hamlet's first words are after the ghost says what he says? Oh, my prophetic soul.
Yeah.
I knew all this.
Yeah.
I know all this. And that's the tragedy.
Right.
Well, Robert, what do you think?
Well, the, you know, because like Jerry, I was struck by this new concept of the ghost that Lynn has that I've only heard in this one paper that he's written. The ghost. So consequently, I'm still digesting, you know. I'm still digesting the paper and that particular point that he's making about the ghost. But the ghost plays such a huge part in the play, compelling Hamlet to revenge his murder. And in the meantime, you've got Fortinbras, who is just spoken about out of just a few sentences by the king, talking about Fortinbras asking back for those, demanding back the lands that Hamlet's father had won and the whole country is preparing for war, possibly against Fortinbras. And you've got Hamlet, who has heard from the ghost saying, avenge my death, my murder. And so consequently, this very huge political event of the threat from Fortinbras is thrown to the wayside, especially as the king is suspicious that Hamlet might know something about his father's murder. So you've got basically the leaders of the nation absolutely not focused on the absolute threat of the moment, which is Fortinbras.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, Fortinbras ends up taking over the country anyway, with Hamlet's dying breath giving him full, Hamlet says, let Fortinbras take over the country as my dying breath.
Mm-hmm.
So with Hamlet seeking to avenge his father and all of that, and Claudius seeking ways to get rid of Hamlet, these occupying occupying so much of their time, these leaders of the country, they are completely negligent of the immediate necessity, the immediate concern of Fortinbras and his warlike aims. So the country's lost.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is one of those tragic themes which was not written simply about the legendary time of the Kingdom of Denmark, but also it was true of Shakespeare's London, and it's true today. I mean, Jerry, in terms of the time when this was performed, what was going on in England?
Well, this was part of the transition to James, who was a completely impotent king who was taken over directly by Paolo Sarpi, directly. James, by 1604, was in Paolo Sarpi's hands.
Sarpi being the Venetian operative.
The Venetian operative who ran the operation in England with Sir Henry Wotton, who was the Venetian ambassador. And you were dealing with a transition. This question of the ghost, this eerie question of the ghost, because, you know, I don't know about Robert, but I'm struck by the fact that the ghost tells him something that he absolutely knows is true. The ghost is not a real ghost. It's him projecting, as Lynn discusses this Homer question, right? Because what Lynn said to us on last Monday night, was that think of the gods as the so-called reason why people don't act to change the situation. Hmm? Project the gods, you know, the gods say this, I'll have bad luck. The gods say that, I can't do it. You know, the gods say this, right?
Right.
And therefore, there seems to be a fate outside the individual determining the action in society or on the stage. And on the stage, you're capable of making that visible. Hmm? Through ghosts, or, you know, I don't know about you, Robert, but I was thinking of Macbeth and the witches, right?
Yeah.
How come the witches know everything that's going to happen? Right?
Yep.
Why do they know that? Hmm? Because
sure, I'll give you another example, which is the scene with the sorceress in Verdi's wonderful tragedy, The Masked Ball, where the conjurer of Satan is there as a visible evidence of the force that's gripping the kingdom. And yet the actual prophecy comes out in the first scene with the two living main protagonists, where The governor refuses to believe that he's under threat of assassination, and his top aide is warning him, "You're about to get assassinated."
Right.
And of course, by the end of the opera, it's the aide who assassinates him.
Yes, exactly. So, why do they know? The reason they know it, I'm convinced of this, is because they know the profile of everybody on the stage, because it is their profile, right?
Yeah.
It is their profile. And therefore, they can know everything that's going to happen because no one's going to break profile. No one is going to step outside. And as Lynn constantly points out, that it's the whole society. Nobody in the whole society is capable of doing anything. But this tragic, this force of tragedy, just play out everything by the rules, right?
Yeah.
And therefore, you can know everything that's going to happen. Everything. Because you know that no one is going to step outside the boundary. Mm? And this is what strikes me about the brilliance of Shakespeare. Because in that discussion that Lynn has on this question of Julius Caesar, right? He references this question when Casca says it's Greek to me.
Yeah, Cicero.
He references Cicero, right? Who is someone who broke outside the boundaries of the insanity. And therefore, he was not asked in on the conspiracy, Cicero.
And look what happened to him.
Well, yeah, he gets killed. He's one of the first people to get killed.
Yeah.
But exactly. So the point is that what Lynn is adding to this, which I've never thought of before, is that there's in the great tragedies, there is a real, tangible existent, which says, here's what you're fated to do.
Yeah.
And you know that from the beginning. And the horror that no one is capable of doing anything but what they're fated to do is the actual horror of the tragedy.
That reminds me, Jerry, so much of, I'm struck by what happened immediately after President Kennedy's assassination, where Robert Kennedy and certain other leaders must have known
yes.
in their prophetic soul what actually went down. And yet, they did nothing. They didn't speak out. They didn't do anything to... And then you had that travesty of the Warren Commission,
right,
which everybody accepted. And, the country, the country's been going downhill rapidly ever since that time. There was that unseen force bending people to its will.
Yeah, that's important, Robert. I hadn't thought of that. Of course, that's true. It used to drive me crazy.
Yeah, I mean, so what Lynn is saying, I think there are enough instances in history and what's going on today to see it as a valid principle.
When the tragedy is properly directed. Somewhere fairly early on, people are getting this idea, the horror of the fact that he will not act. Like you're saying with Robert Kennedy, I'm sure he knew on some level, and like you say, in his prophetic soul, he knew. Everyone who knew politics knew. Now, look at that, contrast that to Lyndon LaRouche, who screams everything from the rooftops.
Well, Jerry, let's take a look at the more recent case of 9/11, where now, in hindsight, many people are coming to realize there was something going on with this. But remember, in January 2001, even before Bush and Cheney took office, in a webcast, Lynn warned that there would be, at some point in the very near future, a Reichstag fire type event. So they could use the powers of the the assumed powers of the executive to impose a police state. And, of course, on 9/11, when the planes were flying into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, there was Lynn on the Jack Stockwell show in Utah discussing precisely in real time, this is what's happening. And look at the unfolding from that time forward, which brings us to the question of Speaker Pelosi. I want to remind our listeners we're listening to the LaRue Show. It's Saturday, November 17th, 2007. And if you want to ask a question of Jerry and Robert, you can send a question in via email to radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub.com. And we're discussing an article in the most recent, or actually last week's issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, The Mask of Nancy Pelosi, The Force of Tragedy. And you can get that from calling us or going on the website. Now, Robert, you've been working, you played Hamlet. You directed what I thought was a groundbreaking performance of the first act of the Julius Caesar by Shakespeare with the LaRouche Youth Movement. When you're presenting a drama, one of the things that Lynn is talking about is the intention of the dramatist to get the audience out of their spectator position and actually put themselves in this arc of history. How do you communicate that when you're performing or when you're directing? How do you get the actors to see that they're presenting something that has to have that different kind of effect on the audience than simply entertainment?
Well, I think one of the most important ways is to bring out the ironies, the obvious ironies that are there, that are composed by the playwright. And especially in the first two acts of Julius Caesar, they're strewn all over the place. And as Lynn says, if you're looking at it from a romantic point of view, you won't notice the ironies. You won't be struck. Mm-hmm. By the fabric of the ironies, the texture. The ironies make up the texture of the play. I guess in music it would be, you know, similar to dissonances that the audience must hear, the orchestra must bring out, as composed by the composer. So, you know, just almost from the beginning of the play, it starts off with this huge irony that one of the tribunes brings out about the people celebrating in the streets the great victory of Caesar. And the tribune brings out, but you guys were saddened and deplored just a short time ago the death of Pompeii. And now you're celebrating Caesar, who defeated Pompeii. You're blockheads. Go home and think about it. Go home and think about what the hell you're really doing. As the first two acts progress, there are all of these ironies that Shakespeare brings out that the actors, the director, have to be aware of, because that's what really makes up the play. That's what gives the play its texture. Mm-hmm. That's what the audience will, when they go home, digest that part, that thing about the play, these huge ironies, and how significant and how it's just the ironies that you have to be aware of, and mm-hmm. that's what the plays are. They're like the brass hoops that hold the play together.
Huh. You know, and the essential irony, Shakespeare writes three plays on Rome and a fourth, which could be argued, on Cymbeline. But the three are Julius Caesar, then Caesar and Cleopatra, or Antony and Cleopatra, and then the third, which is set in a much earlier time, Coriolanus, right?
Yes.
And what's the irony of all three? Rome was a disaster, right? That while when Julius takes over, it goes from a so-called republic, right, to a single ruler, a tyranny, right?
Yeah.
Or a monarchy, you know, it reverts to a monarchy. But what's the irony there? Anthony, who helps him to power, he overthrows, right? It was going to be a triumvirate, and then he seizes power and destroys Anthony and Lepidus, the three triumvirs who originally take over, right?
Yeah.
But what happens? This society is a cutthroat society. And then what Shakespeare does is he takes it back in Coriolanus to 100 years before when it was a republic, and it was a disaster then.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, when Coriolanus comes in, he hates the people. They hate him. It's a society based on power relations and hatred. Right. So rather than let you think, well, the Roman Republic was something to look at, he actually retakes it up and the whole damn place. And that's the point. Because these empires, and one thing you can say about Shakespeare, which I know very well, is that he was a great studier of St. Augustine. And his view of the Roman Empire comes from St. Augustine's City of God. And he knew that any society not based on agape, on the idea of the benefit of the other, or the idea of that your development must affect the development of all others, right? Any society based on any other principle, which is what St. Augustine develops in the City of God, is a society that will destroy itself.
Robert, I'm just curious, as an actor and as someone who has done classical theater, to what extent are these kinds of discussions, do these kinds of discussions take place before a play is done? I mean, how aware are people of this question of the irony or the real principle of tragedy as Lynn is discussing it?
Well, with any competent director and cast, you will have a period of time set for the discussion of the play and the investigation of the play. How much time varies that you put into that. But, you know, as far as Lynn's concept of tragedy, I've never worked with a company that understood that or investigated that at all. So it's something new. Most people do attack a play with a romanticist's point of view. And so consequently, you may have a very good production of a play, mm-hmm. but I think that if all of the actors and the director and the people involved, if they did have this higher concept of tragedy, and especially as Jerry was getting at earlier, how do you see man? Do you see man as a beast, just another beast, or do you see him as a creative being, capable of progressing and growing and making life better for everybody on the concept of agape? And I think that if a company of actors would have that in mind, then the production would automatically have a higher sense of duty. Actually, I think mm-hmm. Lynn even I think his words were a sacred duty to mm-hmm. to bring forth the tragedies as they must be brought out.
Well, you actually engaged in a bit of an experiment with the production you did of Clifford Odets' play, The Big Knife, where I think more so than anything I'd seen, especially with a more modern play, you did attempt to bring out this deeper question of the tragedy confronting all the characters in the aftermath of World War II, where they seem to come back and immediately lose their mission. In thinking back on that, how successful do you think that was in bringing out these ironies that were clearly there with Odets?
Well, I think it was very successful because people that came to see the play didn't see it as the story of some Hollywood actor who committed suicide. Everyone seemed to get the idea that there was. That the tragedy was beyond just an actor killing himself. And a lot of letters and comments that I got pointed out that the people had gotten a bigger sense of what the play was really, the intention of the playwright. One of the things that helped a lot was just understanding the fabric of the society at that time. And you remember when you came in, Harley, to brief us all on that era, the post-World War II era.
On Trumanism.
On Trumanism. That really seemed to get all of the actors on a perspective, the same perspective of the play and why it was written and why it was so important. I mean, when I first decided to do the play and gathered the actors around, some of them asked me, they just thought that it was, you know, it's a big role and Robert wants a big role on stage and, you know. But that wasn't it at all. I felt that the play was really important and needed to be heard. And then the diligence the diligence and the rehearsal and bringing out the themes of the play, I think everybody felt a higher obligation to the play and to the playwright's intention.
Well, as someone who saw it several times, I saw the actual mission change in the sense over the from the rehearsals through the final performances, and it actually was quite a powerful play, and so in that sense, I think you did succeed with that. I'd like to shift the discussion just a little bit now by bringing in Joanne McAndrew, who is, let's just say, in the middle of this ongoing tragedy that Lynn identified, namely that this question of the Congress capitulating repeatedly to this unseen force that seems to be driving Nancy Pelosi to lead the nation to suicide. Joanne, how conscious are you when you and the other LaRouche Youth Movement members go into the Congress now of taking this idea of tragedy from Lynn and trying to communicate to congressional aides and others who probably have no idea of what we're talking about in terms of the principle of tragedy and certainly don't see themselves as trapped in tragic behavior? How conscious are you, and how helpful is this concept for you to take up the task of moving these congressmen?
Well, I think it's becoming more and more conscious, largely in particular with this question of Pelosi. It's very evident as to how this question of the fears and what Lynn brings up of you know, the mask of Pelosi and the fear that that creates in other individuals' minds within Congress. Because when Lynn said, okay, we're going to go after Pelosi, we're going to, you know, go out there and tell people they should fire the Speaker of the House. We didn't have any concept at that point as to how many people actually agreed with that. I mean, it was something that was just nobody talked about on the streets until, you know, we took out this huge banner with Pelosi's face and, you know, bolts coming out each side of her head. You know, this big banner saying fire Pelosi, and, you know, we thought it would be quite controversial. But, of course, as soon as we took it out on the streets, you know, people are giving us thumbs up. You know, people are almost fainting on the street saying, oh, my God, get me a doctor. I never thought I'd agree with LaRouche. you know, this is the one thing that I'll agree with LaRouche on. You have other people saying, well, look, you know, I don't usually read LaRouche's stuff, but, you know, you better give me that one. Because this is something that so many people in Congress, you know, see the problem with, you know, neither Republicans, but also, you know, a lot of Democrats that just see what Pelosi's doing to the party, but either feel powerless themselves or more so are terrified to actually go against what they think is, you know, the way things are being done. And it's sort of something that, you know, it's being discussed throughout this discussion is, you know, just the control of the fears on the population. But it's also something we've seen in the case of impeachment. So many people want Cheney out of there, but it wasn't until you had somebody that kind of stood out, which of course was Lynn, to say, you know, Cheney's got to be impeached, that you've really gotten to the point today where you have, you know, what, 20 or so congressmen that have, you know, have signed on for impeachment. That otherwise you would just have a population going along with whatever's being dictated to them, generally by the culture, and, you know, that you have, like we were discussing, the characters on stage is kind of having been profiled, that they will just, they'll perform the tragedy as it's given to them. And I just want to bring up that, you know, the other crucial thing that Lynn hits at in the paper is the question of culture as a subject of strategy. Because that's, and you think of theater as well. I mean, theater has been completely destroyed. If the United States Congress sat down and watched a good performance of Hamlet or, you know, Schiller's Don Carlos, I think that they would be, you know, very affected by it. But you also have these a lack of the culture that will develop a population that doesn't play out a tragedy.
Mm-hmm. So, Joanne, you can see then what Lynn is describing, in a sense, as the force of the silent electric fence, which controls the behavior and the statements and so on of the Congress. You actually can almost see that.
Well, yeah, I'll give you an example. A couple of us met with a congressional office. Now, this is an office that has actually endorsed Kucinich's House Resolution 333 for impeachment. And this was the day before Kucinich was going to use the privilege resolution to bring impeachment to the floor of Congress. And we met with the chief of staff. He didn't even know that Kucinich was about to bring this privilege resolution to the floor to start off with. But he proceeded to give us the Rohatyn Schultz, you know, via Pelosi line of the Democratic Party, that we have more important things to take care of. You know, we have the agenda of the Democratic Party that is, you know, it's going to take too much time to impeach. We can't waste that time. You know, we're worried about health care, children's health care, and the war in Iraq, which, of course, is, you know, when Steny Hoyer, after, you know, Kucinich's resolution came to the floor, the statement Steny Hoyer puts out is that we are not going to impeach. We got more important things to worry about, which is health care and the war in Iraq. Now, this is a staffer who, when we talked about the 10.7% approval rating, laughed and said, oh, really, it's actually that high? Like, I thought it was lower. So he's someone who, you know, completely admitted that everything the Democratic Party is doing is getting nowhere, but still proceeded to give you just the line of the party as to why it is that we cannot change what we're doing. We just have to keep playing out, even though he could, you know, somewhat see in his mind where this was going to get us, which was, you know, worse than nowhere. You know, he would continue to...
Hello?
Yeah, Robert, I think one of the things Joanne was suggesting is that you work with the LIM members in D.C. to do a command performance of Don Carlos, Schiller's Don Carlos, before the Congress.
Nothing would please me more.
Me neither.
I went to a function here in L.A., and I was speaking to Congressman Becerra from California. And I walked up to him and I said, "Hey, Congressman, who the hell sold the Constitution to Nancy Pelosi?" He said, "Well, what do you mean?" "So what gives her the right to tell us what articles, what part of the Constitution is solely her jurisdiction? I mean, Constitution belongs to all of us, doesn't it? "Sure it does, Robert, sure. So why is impeachment off the table then? What gives her the right to do that?" Mm. And he says, "Oh, well, we can't do that. It would take too much time. We've got so many important things." The same old line, right?
Yeah.
And it's so frustrating. And I said, "Well, this was before this new thing that Lynn has brought up about Bloomberg," but I said, "Well, if we don't impeach, he says, why is it so important to impeach Cheney?" I said, "Well, because, you know, we'll get out of the war and innocent people will quit dying. And that way, if Giuliani becomes president, he'll be too afraid to do something similar to what Cheney's doing." And his response, "Oh, Giuliani is never going to be president." So, you know, it's just all this sophistical arguments, it's just turning a blind eye to the fact that people are being killed. People are dying. Innocent people in Iraq are dying. Our soldiers are dying. And it's this, you know, this concept, again, goes back to what Lynn talks about. What do you consider man to be? Is it just a beast? Are we just beasts? Cannon fodder? Or do we really, really care about them?
Mm-hmm.
And are we going to act on that? And, you know, it's just, we see this tragedy unfolding, and it's horrifying. But it's also very interesting.
Well, from a clinical standpoint,
yeah,
unfortunately, we don't live in a clinic. We live in a world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Jerry, to get back at this, picking up on what Joanne was saying, part of what you do is you oversee the function of the whole national and international deployment. To what extent are we seeing some changes now in not so much in the Congress, but in state and local officials? Are they beginning to realize that they do have both the power to act and the responsibility to act in the face of this tragedy?
Well, you see it most dramatically, which, in fact, your Houston group is in the middle of, which is in New Orleans. The report we got today was that over 60, or close to 60, elected officials in this League of Cities meeting signed to get the HPPA. The Homeowners and Bankers Protection Act. And this is a beautiful counterposition to, Robert, what you were reflecting on this Becerra thing, right? Because here, the states and the local officials cannot duck this foreclosure question. People are coming into their offices desperate, right? And they want answers. And in fact, we found out today that Chaka Fatah, the congressman from Philadelphia, spoke in unofficial capacity, but fairly clearly that he was representing a group of black legislators that say there must be now a six-month moratorium on all foreclosures. That happened this morning. Right? It's on his website. Why is this happening? Because the LaRouche Youth Movement, along with others, backed up by others, is giving direct leadership and answers, right? That as opposed to the tragic nature of the Congress, you're getting from outside that the situation in the state and local officials where they're in reality and they're saying, look, what you're saying would work. And we're going to act. But you could not, without the LaRouche Youth Movement and Lynn and what we propose, they could not act. They would be paralyzed in facing this, the magnitude of this crisis.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's precisely the, what does not happen in any tragedy. Robert and I have probably between us read them all, right? There's no hero who steps outside the tragedy. So it makes it a tragedy.
Yeah.
They may yell about it. They may indicate they might do something, right? But nobody, there's no sense of someone like a LaRouche who gets in there and just tells the truth at all moments of time. And makes the, you know, it's not this romantic screaming and yelling. As everyone knows, Lynn is completely ironic, right? I mean, that's where, you know, the screws in the head. Apparently, Nancy Pelosi has this funny kind of
facelift
where the screws are in her head so she can tighten her own skin, you know. So that's where the screws in the head thing comes from, right? With that plastic smile of hers, right? You know, and that we do have a very funny poster of King Kong. It's just a picture of King Kong, you know, of the old King Kong. And it says, this is what happens when Nancy loses a screw. Right. She becomes King Kong. Right. You know, and you know, this is what her face looks like. Right. You need humor. You need irony.
Yeah.
But tough irony, not joking. I mean, hard, tough irony to break people out of the sincerity of feeling, you know. It's sort of like this My Space Facebook thing we're doing, right? You need hard, sharp irony. This is why, you know, Schiller said this beautiful thing. He said, if there were a lot more comedy, there would be a lot less tragedy. You know, and this is the role of the LaRouche Youth Movement. They're the guys who go in there and show Nancy Pelosi with her screws on the side of her head. We're the guys who go in there and sing the kinds of canons. Fat Ass Nazi was a hot one during the last campaign, where we shook Connecticut. This whole state of Connecticut was singing Cheney is a Fat Ass Nazi. And, you know...
Through classical canonical form.
Wouldn't have worked otherwise. You wouldn't have had the right irony, right? It only works if it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? That's what makes it totally ironic. So you see through the use of these classical compositional methods, you break people out of this sincerity of feeling, right?
Yeah.
And you know, but the point is they also have to visualize the horror, and this is what the great classical tragedies do. You visualize the absolute horror of, you know, by, you know, in a properly performed Hamlet, by the time when he sings, oh, these region, I would fat the, you know, this kites, what's the line?
Fat all the region kites with this slave's awful.
With this slave's awful. By then you know he's bullshitting.
Mm-hmm.
By that screaming, ranting rage. And then he says, well, now I got to catch him at a play. By then, you know it's over.
Well, I'm always struck by the relationship between Hamlet and Don Carlos. In the play Don Carlos, you've got this young man, the heir to the throne, who is completely destabilized, completely turned into himself, isolated, and you've got certain spies and higher in the hierarchy of the government purposely trying to keep him off balance so that they continue to have the king's ear. People like Lerma and Domingo and Alva. And they think nothing about the torment that the young man is going through. And in fact, do all they can to continue to torment him. And it's not unlike, the play is called Don Carlos, the Infante of Spain, the Child of Spain.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
And, then you have Poza, who has these great ideas to be able to change the status quo, to change the world. And the king seduces him into basically becoming one of those spies, one of those people who are working against their own best interest. And you see all these kids on Facebook and it's a deliberate attempt to keep them off balance, to keep them destabilized. And a great tragedy has these reverberations that we feel.
You know, we had an interesting discussion here this morning. I'm in Los Angeles now, and someone brought up that besides the youth, many of the youth seem ashamed and embarrassed when you ask them about MySpace. Some, of course, are just, so what? Hands off my cyberspace.
Yeah.
But what we're finding is an interesting response from parents. And what parents are sort of saying, we've gotten this a lot the last few days since we've been making this a point in the organizing. They're saying, well, I know it's bad, but I can't do anything about it. This is what all the kids are doing.
Yeah.
And in a sense, you talk about this question of tragedy. And, Joanne, I'd like your thoughts on this because, you see a generation. A lot of the LaRouche youth movement, the members are now 23, 24, 28, some are even 30. And you look at the 18-year-olds today and you realize that someone who's 18 today was 11 when 9/11 took place, that their most conscious development has occurred under Bush Cheney, and they've been plugged into cyberspace from the beginning. And here you have this, in a sense, the tragedy of the parents who say there's nothing you can do about it. Did you have some thoughts on this, Joanne?
Yeah, I think this is the question of the cultural battle that we're waging, and particularly with the campaign that we're launching on MySpace and Facebook, because we've got to fight for the souls of the next generation of young people. Because the tragedy we're faced with today is going to be, a million times worse when that generation becomes the leadership of the world, when they've spent their entire youth, in virtual reality. And, it's these different things. I know Lynn's, written this new paper on extreme events, talking about these murders in Perugia, and then, I found it when I found out about this, these 18-year-olds in Detroit, literally playing out a scene from this manhunt video game, chopping off someone's head with a saw and then taking a blowtorch to his body. I mean, this is a tragedy of the next generation of, I mean, there is no youth culture that's going to develop a generation to lead the development of the world for the generations to come. And it's a crucial battle that we've got the fight around the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act, you've got the financial system collapsing now, you have the fight for the impeachment of Cheney, but at the same time, we have to fight to change the culture as a whole because otherwise we'll be constantly faced with an impending tragedy.
And I think the point on this is that we have to be as dramatic as possible, and I don't mean that in the romantic sense, but in the sense we've been discussing, to make that tragedy real to people. And I think it's very significant that, as you talked earlier, Joanne, about the question really is culture is the subject of tragedy, or as a subject of tragedy, that in presenting the way that the youth are being destroyed, at the same time, you present the alternative. What is a human society? What should mm-hmm. young people be doing with their minds if they're not on Carjack 6 or making up new identities to try and pick up women on MySpace? You know, what should be the subject of mental creative activity? The discovery of Kepler, the work on Bach, and also, as we've been talking, rediscovering from this standpoint the classics of literature.
Yeah, well, Lynn, and not just the question of culture as a subject of tragedy, but Lynn brings it up as a subject of strategy, of geopolitical
right.
brand strategy. Because this is the one thing that if you want to have a population that's doomed to fail, you know, you destroy the culture, and sooner or later, you know, you'll end up in a dark age. So
we have a little less than 4 minutes. I just like to know to close this out. Jerry and Robert, give you a couple minutes to give some final thoughts on this for today. Jerry?
Well, yeah, sure. The whole point of Lynn's paper, you have to read it, because what it is a piece of thorough composition. He's establishing this question of tragedy, the force of tragedy, and it's a thorough piece of composition from the standpoint of in a sense, the denial of universal physical principle, the denial of human identity, right? But that there is this eerie, and it's truthful. We've seen societies that have destroyed themselves. In the case of Hamlet, the Denmark, Danish society, right? In the case of Robert was pointing out, Spanish society, in the case of Don Carlo, right? So that the irony of the situation is that while the force of tragedy is not an actual universal principle, it's a quasi universal principle. But if understood from the standpoint of the inability to access a human identity, then it's in that area, right, that you're looking at what Lynn is saying.
And Robert?
Yes. Well, I think that if we didn't have the LaRouche youth movement, I would be much more pessimistic about our ability to get out of this, finding our way through this unfolding tragedy. But I just have to say that I am very proud to be able to working with the LaRouche youth. They're really taking up this concept of tragedy and being able to perform it competently, so that we can use it as a tool to intervene whenever possible in our society. I think we have a small nucleus of youth that are committed to this, and that's really all you need as a starting point. Great things can be done by a few people that are committed. And Joe and all of the other youth that are working on the drama are making huge strides. In the understanding and the ability to perform these great tragedies, and I've been Jerry, I know you're really interested in Euripides.
Yes.
I recently read Iphigenia in Aulis.
Oh, wow.
And that's like a template of...
Talk about anti-war. This is one of the most powerful anti-war plays ever written, ever.
Yeah.
We're going to have to cut at that point because we've run out of time. This is actually a very rich field of discussion. And thank you for listening to the LaRouche Show today. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Robert, Jerry, and Joanne, thank you very much for joining us, and see you next week.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. Thank you, Holly.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.